Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've got this really interesting lecture you shared from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. It's all about the evolution of populations.
Yeah, microevolution, basically.
Exactly. And our mission today is, well, to kind of break it down for you, get to the core mechanics of how species change genetically.
And we're not talking vast geological timescales here. Dr. Hoffman makes the point that this can happen fast, like really fast, sometimes just one generation to the next.
He kicks off with that classic question, the one that seems to trip people up. He asks, is this finch evolving?
And the answer is a hard no, right? An individual can't evolve.
Right. If you go to the gym, get really buff.
Yeah.
You've changed, sure, but you haven't evolved in the biological sense.
That's just development within a lifetime. It's not heritable, not passed on. Evolution needs reproduction. It happens between generations.
So it's about the group, the collective gene pool changing.
Which means only populations evolve. That's the key unit.
Okay, so let's nail down that definition then. What is a population in this context?
Dr. Hoffman defines it clearly. It's a group of individuals, same species, in a specific area, and crucially, where they're actually interbreeding, reproducing.
That shared gene pool, that's the whole game.
Yeah, and thinking about it that way really shifts how you see adaptation. It's not about one organism trying harder. It's about which genes become more common in the whole group over time.
Okay, let's get into the scientific nitty-gritty. The actual definition of evolution at this level. It's not some vague idea of change.
No, it's quantifiable. Dr. Hoffman's definition is a change in allele frequencies over time, or, you know, between generations.
Allele frequencies. Okay, break that down.
An allele is just a version of a gene. Like, you might have a gene for eye color, and the alleles are blue, brown, green. So the frequency is just how common each version is. Like, what percentage of the eye color genes in the whole population are the blue version? That's the allele frequency. P for dominant, Q for recessive, usually.
Right. And that connects to Hardy-Weinberg. Yeah. I remember that from bio.
Exactly. P plus Q equals 1 for the alleles. P squared plus 2PQ plus Q squared equals 1 for the individual's genotypes. Hardy-Weinberg is the baseline. It describes a population that's not evolving.
So if you measure P and Q in generation 1, and they're different in generation 2...
Bingo. Evolution has occurred. By definition, the frequency's changed.
But the example he gives, it's kind of shocking how fast it can be.
Oh, the seed cracker finches. Yeah, that's a classic. There was this big drought back in 76.
And suddenly only the really tough old seeds were left.
Right. And it turned out, just by chance, some finches had alleles for slightly thicker, stronger beaks.
So they could crack the tough seeds.
They survived better, they reproduced more, and guess what? They passed on those stout beak alleles.
And the result?
A measurable shift. The average bill depth in the whole finch population increased. And get this, it happened in just two generations.
Wow. That's microevolution caught in the act. Just a frequency shift.
Proof of concept right there.
Okay, so for any of this change to happen, evolution needs, like, raw material to work with. Variation. Where does that actually come from?
Good question. We see the phenotype that's the trait itself, like the horse's coat color Dr. Hoffman mentions, but that comes from the underlying genotype, the DNA.
And with the horse coat color, he points out it's not just black or white, right? It's a whole spectrum.
Yeah, a continuous range, very light to very dark. That usually points to polygenic inheritance.
Meaning multiple genes are involved.
Exactly. Lots of different genes, all contributing a little bit to the final look, like human skin color or height. It gives natural selection more subtle variations to work with.
But here's a crucial point he made. Selection only cares about heritable variation.
Yeah.
Stuff passed down in DNA.
Right. He used that caterpillar example. If it eats oak flowers, it turns yellow. Eats oak leaves, turns green. That's an environmental effect.
Not coded in its genes.
Exactly. So that color change, it can't be passed on. Natural selection ignores it completely. Same if you become a bodybuilder, your kids don't inherit your muscles.
So where does new genetic information, totally new variations, come from?
The ultimate source is always mutation. Accidental changes in the DNA code itself.
And these are random, right? Not directed.
Totally random. They don't happen because an organism needs them. It's just errors in copying or damage.
Yeah.
Pure chance.
Okay, but if mutations are random, why aren't we constantly seeing, you know, weird new traits pop up all the time?
That's a great point, Dr. Hoffman clarifies. Most mutations actually have no effect on the phenotype. They're silent.
How come?
He gives three main reasons. First, think about how much DNA we have. About 99% of human DNA is non-coding. It's like junk DNA or regulatory stuff, not actual genes coding for proteins.
So a random hit is likely to land in the non-coding part.
Exactly. It hits the space between the important files, metaphorically speaking. Second, even if a mutation hits within a gene in eukaryotes like us, it might land in an intron.
Those are the bits that get cut out.
Yeah, during RNA processing, the introns are spliced out, so the mutation gets removed before the protein is even made. It never sees the light of day.
Okay, two layers of protection. What's the third?
The redundancy of the genetic code itself. Remember, there are 64 possible three-letter codons, but they only code for 20 amino acids.
Right, so multiple codons mean the same amino acid.
Precisely. So a mutation could change a single DNA letter within an exon, the part that does code for protein, but the altered codon might still code for the exact same amino acid.
A silent mutation, the protein ends up identical.
Exactly. So non-coding DNA, introns, and code redundancy. It means most random mutations just don't change the final product. That gives us genetic stability.
Makes sense. Okay, so we have variation from random mutation, and evolution is the change in allele frequency. What actually causes those frequencies to change? The mechanisms.
Dr. Hoffman lays out three main mechanisms. Only one is the really famous one, though.
Natural selection. Darwin's big idea.
That's the one. And it's unique because it's the only mechanism that reliably leads to adaptation traits that improve survival and reproduction. It's not random. It actively favors beneficial alleles.
Okay, what are the other two?
The second is genetic drift.
Drift. Sounds kind of random.
It absolutely is. Think of a random event, a storm wipes out part of a population, someone steps on a patch of rare flowers.
It kills individuals by chance, not because they were less fit.
Exactly. It's evolution by sheer accident. Some alleles might disappear, others might become common, just because of who happened to survive, regardless of their traits.
So drift reduces genetic variation.
It does. And because it's random, it doesn't reliably lead to better adaptation. It can even make harmful alleles more common by chance.
Wow. Okay. Are there specific types of drift?
Yeah, he mentioned two key ones, the founder effect. A small group breaks off, maybe gets blown to an island. That small group probably isn't perfectly representative of the original population's alleles.
So their new population might have weirdly high frequencies of certain traits just because of who the founders were.
Yep. Pure chance based on the founding sample. The other is the bottleneck effect. This happens when a population crashes, disease, disaster, habitat loss.
Like the Illinois prairie chickens he mentioned.
Perfect example. A huge number died randomly due to habitat destruction. The few survivors had only a fraction of the original genetic diversity. Their alleles, good or bad, now define the future population simply because they were the lucky ones.
Okay, so selection is directional adaptation, drift is random chance. What's the third?
Gene flow. This is basically migration. Alleles moving into or out of a population when individuals migrate and breed.
So it mixes things up.
Right. It can introduce new alleles or change the frequencies of existing ones. Like drift, it causes evolution, a change in allele frequencies. But it also doesn't reliably increase fitness or adaptation. It just shuffles the deck between populations.
He had that bird example from the Netherlands, right?
Yeah.
Showing gene flow can actually work against selection.
Yeah, that was a great illustration. You have these island bird populations. The central island gets more migrants from the mainland than the eastern island does.
And the mainland birds aren't adapted to the island.
Exactly. They bring their mainland alleles with them. This constant influx of non-adapted genes via gene flow actually slows down or counteracts the natural selection that's trying to adapt the central island birds to their specific island environment.
So the central population ends up less well-adapted than the more isolated eastern one because gene flow is messing things up.
Precisely. It shows these mechanisms aren't always working together. Sometimes they're in conflict.
Fascinating. Okay, since natural selection is the only one driving reliable adaptation, let's dig into how it works. He mentioned different modes.
Right, using that classic rodent coat color example. Three main modes.
Go on.
First is directional selection. Imagine the environment changes, maybe dark rocks become common. Selection favors the darker mice. The whole population curve shifts towards darker coats over time.
Makes sense. One extreme is favored.
Then there's disruptive selection. Here, the environment favors both extremes, say, very light rocks and very dark shadows, but the intermediate brown mice stand out everywhere.
So the middle ground is bad.
Right. Selection favors both light and dark mice, potentially splitting the population into two distinct groups over time. The curve gets two peaks.
And third.
Stabilizing selection. This happens when the intermediate phenotype is already the best fit. Selection weeds out the extremes, too light or too dark, and favors the average. The curve gets taller and narrower, reinforcing the norm.
Okay, directional, disruptive, stabilizing. What about sexual selection? That's still selection, right?
Yep, it's a specific type of natural selection, but the driving force isn't survival, it's mate choice.
Ah, like the peacock's tail.
Exactly. That huge tail is terrible for survival, easy for predators to spot, hard to fly. It's maladaptive in that sense.
But the peons dig it.
They do. So males with the biggest, brightest tails get to reproduce more, passing on the alleles for big, bright tails. Reproduction trumps survival sometimes.
But Dr. Hoffman mentioned that frog study, where the attractive trait was linked to fitness.
Right. Sometimes the sexually selected trait is an honest signal of good genes. In those frogs, females preferred males with longer, louder calls. And it turned out the offspring of those males actually had higher survival rates. So the attractive call was linked to overall genetic quality.
Okay, so it's complex. Now, what about maintaining bad alleles? He brought up sickle cell.
Ah, yes. The classic example of heterozygote advantage. This is a form of balancing selection.
Remind me how that works.
Okay, so with sickle cell, if you get two copies of the recessive sickle cell allele, you get the disease, which is often fatal. That's bad.
Homozygous recessive is maladaptive.
Right. If you get two copies of the normal dominant allele, you're fine regarding sickle cell, but you're very susceptible to malaria.
Homozygous dominant is also potentially bad in certain areas.
Exactly. But the heterozygote, the person with one normal allele and one sickle cell allele, they don't get sickle cell disease, and they have significant resistance to malaria.
They have the best of both worlds, in a way.
In malaria-prone regions, yes. They have the highest fitness, the highest survival and reproduction rate.
So selection actively maintains the harmful sickle cell allele in the population because the heterozygote form is so advantageous there.
Precisely. It's an evolutionary trade-off. Keeping a bad allele around because it provides a benefit in a different context when paired with a good allele.
Wow. Okay, one more balancing act you mentioned. Frequency-dependent selection. The fish.
Yeah, the scale-eating cichlids. Some are left-mouthed, some are right-mouthed. They attack prey from one side.
And their success depends on how common they are.
Exactly. If most predators are left-mouthed, the prey fish get wise and learn to watch their right flank more carefully.
Which gives the rare right-mouthed predators an advantage.
Right. They can sneak up on the unguarded left flank. So being rare becomes advantageous.
So the right-mouthed fish do better, reproduce more, and become more common.
Until they become the majority. Then the prey fish switch focus, learn to guard their left flank, and suddenly the now rare left-mouthed fish have the advantage.
And the cycle just keeps going back and forth.
Yep. The frequency of the left-mouth versus right-mouth allele oscillates over time. Neither one gets eliminated because its fitness depends entirely on how rare or common it is.
That's pretty cool. So wrapping up, Dr. Hoffman really emphasized that evolution isn't clean.
Not at all. It's full of compromises and trade-offs, like the frog needing to call to attract a mate, even though that call also attracts bats that eat it.
Necessary risk.
And he stressed that natural selection never leads to perfection.
Why not?
Two big reasons. One, the environment is always changing. What's adaptive today might not be tomorrow. The target keeps moving.
Okay.
And two, maybe the biggest point, selection can only work with the variations that already exist. It tinkers, it modifies what's there. It can't go back to the drawing board and design something perfectly optimal from scratch.
It's constrained by history.
Exactly. It's always making adjustments to an imperfect starting point.
Okay, so let's sum up this deep dive. Evolution, at its core, is that measurable change in allele frequencies.
Driven by three things: natural selection, genetic drift, and gene flow.
But as Dr. Hoffman showed, only natural selection consistently pushes towards adaptation, making organisms better suited to their environment.
Even then, it's dealing with a randomness from drift, mixing from gene flow, and it's always stuck making trade-offs because it can only work with the genetic material available.
That idea of evolution being constrained by history, only tinkering with what's there, it really makes you think about ourselves, doesn't it?
Totally. We're products of that messy, imperfect process. Yeah. Millions of years of evolutionary compromises.
Right. So thinking about that constraint that selection can't start fresh, what's a common human trait, maybe slightly maladaptive, that seems to exist just because evolution had to work with a pre-existing structure. Something for you, the listener, to ponder.
Oh, that's a good one. Like chronic back pain. Our spines are basically modified horizontal structures forced to work vertically. Bipedalism happened relatively fast, evolutionarily speaking.
Yeah, it wasn't designed from the ground up for walking upright. It was adapted from a four-legged plan.
Leading to all sorts of problems. It's a classic example of an imperfect solution because you couldn't just scrap the spine and start over.
Well, what about choking? The fact that our air passage and food passage cross paths in the throat, that's just not great design.
Not ideal. But it's a holdover from our fish ancestors' gill structure, repurposed. Again, evolution tinkered, it didn't redesign. Wisdom teeth that don't fit, same idea.
Imperfect solutions are everywhere, a direct consequence of how evolution actually works at the population level.
Documented in those shifting allele frequencies.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully this gives you a clearer picture of microevolution in action. Keep looking for those population level changes. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.